The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. And on this episode, we're continuing our conversation around large-scale narrative wargaming. And it doesn't get much more large-scale than a campaign that's been running for more than 13 years. My guest today, Padre, runs Talia's Troubles, which is an absolute gem of a YouTube channel. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy getting a wee peek under the hood to learn about everything that goes into it. I'll also stick links in the show notes to a chat that Padre had with Josh on the Crown of Command podcast, which got into his hobby origin story. I didn't try to replicate that here, as I wanted to use our time to really get into the nuts and bolts of running a campaign like this. But yeah, that conversation with Josh is a really good one, and I'd thoroughly recommend checking it out as well. Just before we dive in, I've got a wee favour to ask of you too. If you're someone who left the hobby in your late teens and came back to an adult life, then I'd love to ask you some questions for a midlife hobby renaissance project I'm working on. That sounds very grandiose, doesn't it? But if you've got a spare 10 minutes, a cup of coffee, and the inclination to do some introspection, then head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/survey, and I'd love to learn more about your story, your opinions, your experiences, and all that sort of stuff. So again, that's bedroombattlefields.com/survey, and I'll put a link in the show notes too. All right, onwards to my chat with Padre then, who had said in our Discord community after Jason's episode where Rick Priestley went out that he'd really enjoyed that conversation, but it had left him feeling a wee bit confused. So I thought I'd kick things off by asking him to elaborate on that.
Yeah, I must admit, it was almost a surprise to hear them talking about it as if it was a novelty, as if narrative wargaming was a thing of the past, which people are rediscovering or need to revisit. Because basically since 1983, with the black and white first edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battles, what was it? The Mass Combat Fantasy Battle role-playing game? I can't remember. It was a weird combination in the title of it. But we'd been doing narrative stuff. In fact, before even Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay came about, we were using those original rules for both wargaming and roleplaying. And having always games mastered narrative games, campaigns, it never occurred to me that it was a rarity. I knew there was a tournament scene out there, and this idea of leagues, semi-finals and finals and that kind of thing. But I assumed outside of that scene, everyone was creating narrative campaigns and unfolding sagas, but apparently not.
Yeah, and I mean, what you're doing with the Big Small Worlds project and Talia's Troubles is really, like, you've gone really in-depth with this over a long period of time. Now, it's obviously attracted a very dedicated fan base as well. I guess, you know, a lot of people are seeing your end product, the way that you're presenting it to the world. But I'm kind of interested to get under the hood here and talk about, you know, what's going on with this campaign. What is it? How is it set up and how does it work? So, like, if we strip away the presentation and the videos and stuff, could you give the listener, anyone who's not familiar with it, just a summary of the campaign, the story, and you know, the kind of work that goes into it on a weekly basis?
Yeah. It's Mighty Empires at its root. I've been using that system for, well, since Mighty Empires came out. I know I borrowed some elements from the old General's Compendium, but I couldn't tell you what the elements were now, because as well as the Mighty Empires and the General's Compendium, there's been the house rules that have been developed over several campaigns, even pre-internet campaigns, certainly pre-YouTube and such. And then even more rules, like the main difference with this campaign compared to your basic Mighty Empires rules is subsistence. We realised in earlier campaigns, armies were getting huge because people, once they started conquering things and getting supply points and getting ever more supply points, not just from the loot, but from their newly enlarged realms, their armies were becoming so bloated. I remember we tried to correct it very early on by saying you can only put 5,000 points of your army on the tabletop. So if you've got a 7,000 point army, you've got to decide what units go on the tabletop. It's a very unsatisfactory way of doing it because you'd think, well, what are the other 2,000 points doing? Surely they would be coming round in a flank attack and such. But this time, supply points don't just buy reinforcements or replace casualties. They are needed, one supply point every season, for the subsistence of every 1,000 points of troops. And it seems to have worked. It's created a balance on the army sizes. And yeah, I mean, obviously, the campaign's 13 years old, so it's an old rule now. But considering this is like the eighth campaign that I put pictures out for, because the earlier ones were all on forums and such, it still feels like my new campaign. But yeah, Mighty Empires at root, because it's games mastered, there's all sorts of little touches you can put in. Like movement. Theoretically, you can move, I think it is, 2 hexes a turn. And we've got a rule that if you're in your own realm or you're on roads, maybe 3 hexes a turn. But because there's a games master involved, if I know someone's given orders to really move quickly, if I know they're on roads or the weather's good or there's very few artillery elements or kind of heavy things to slow them down, I'll often say, right, they've done the 3 hexes. On a 4, 5, or 6, they'll squeeze another hex of movement out. So I'm constantly adding all sorts of extra little, not rules, but extra events, extra twists to how things work. Try and do it fairly. I don't care if the good guys win or the bad guys win, as long as there's a good story, which seems to happen whoever wins. So yeah, games mastered, Mighty Empires at root.
Yeah, I mean, you'll have to forgive my ignorance a wee bit because I don't know a massive amount about Mighty Empires. Can't even say it, evidently, but it seems to me to be a very zoomed out game. Like, we're not even talking about 6 mil troops or that. It seems completely like map level. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a hex map. The players got in a game world map, which had no hexes on it, and only had large settlements on it and such. And they got the hex map, but with more detail closer to their realm, and certainly lots of detail within their own realm. And armies, I think the original term was banners. So the entire realm army has to be balanced as per the army composition rules. And if you take casualties, you have to try and get regain the balance as your first priority whenever you're using supply points to repair casualties and such. But the banners don't have to be balanced because you could take all your special troops and rare troops and heroes, put them in a banner of, say, 2,000 points and have them march off, leaving all the core at home. So in the original Mighty Empires, that banner would just be a 2,000-point banner. But there was always an element. We did play Mighty Empires originally as a board game. But even then, we were also playing it. Now, that was just a while away, an afternoon. But we were also playing it as a means to create a story and a narrative behind tabletop games as well. But yeah, the crazy thing is the players, I don't know if they always realise that the possibilities. If at any point a player, because each player is effectively role-playing one character, their player character, the lord or the king or the general of an army. If they were ever to say to me, right, I want more detail about this particular region, then I would just roll a dice for what their advisors and geographers and whatever can come up with, and I'd pretty much give them all the detail they wanted. Because there's meant to be this world of NPCs, this court and clerks and all these people around them. But players sometimes mistakenly still see it as if it is a board game and those limitations are there. Only in certain aspects. I mean, when it comes to devising Machiavellian plots, they're very keen to have their advisors come up with umpteen alternatives and to really role-play it. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in that synergy between Mighty Empires. And I think I heard you tell Josh you're playing, is it Fantasy 8th edition? Did I get that right?
Yeah. The campaign started during the live period of 8th edition. And because it's 13 years old, it just continued. The thought of, I toyed momentarily with the idea of, oh, well, we'll convert to the old world. But not only would I have to change the base size on literally umpteen armies worth of figures, but we'd have to play around with all the armies, the points costs. The admin work would be atrocious. So we just thought, well, we'll see this one through, however long it takes in 8th edition. And then maybe if we do something again sometime, we'll think about using a different rule set. I could have done it with 3rd edition and such, but a lot of the players were active Warhammer players at the time and they were used to 8th. And I needed to settle on one set of rules because I've got the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 6th, 7th and 8th rules all swimming around in my head. And unless I try and concentrate on just the 8th, I end up quoting rules and trying to apply rules from all sorts of systems or from editions. The only ones I missed, I'm sure this doesn't please Josh, a 4th and 5th, which of course Crown of Command, they seem to be 4th and 5th edition focused. But I always found them a little bit hero hammer and I wanted the armies, I wanted the rank and file to be important. So I stuck with 3rd through 4th and 5th and now I'm sticking with 8th through into Old World.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're doing the right thing. Like the rules should be there to support the story and not the other way around. So I don't think it's too important what, I don't think anyone will be precious about what rules that you're using.
Yeah.
So I'm interested then, like, how does this kind of look? Like, do you get the guys round and quote unquote play a game of Mighty Empires or run the campaign? Are you sitting around the table with Mighty Empires and then whenever a battle is arranged or, you know, armies clash, then you organise a game of Warhammer? Like, is that kind of how it works?
There's no sitting round a table like a board game.
Right.
It's all done with emails and phone calls and pub meetings. I mean, some of the players aren't even in this country, so and they have stand-in players commanding their armies whenever there's a tabletop game. And some of them were old next-door neighbours who now just live on the other side of the village, so I get to go to the pub with that guy and go through everything with him. But it's done like play-by-mail or play-by-email game, with phone calls and meetups. And I'll send out the reports, as well as the stories. I create a general end-of-season report, which becomes the basis of the individual players' reports. But each one of those reports, I mean, the huge long essays at the end of each season, each one of those has extra elements that only they know, whether they're right or wrong, but information for them and their particular circumstances and the composition, the casualties they've received, this, that and the other. The general report then becomes the basis of a story that I put out illustrated on my website, which will then become one of the campaign videos when the campaign videos catch up with that particular story. I'm still a little bit behind. I think I'm 6 videos behind the real end of the campaign. I don't mean the end. I mean the current moment in the campaign. So that they get these very detailed reports at the end of every season. They also, if they're with a force, then they're getting reports all the way through the season as well. I mean, if they stay at home and send armies out, then they'll get messages every now and again, but they'll get most of the information in the end-of-season report. But if they're with an army, I have to send them stuff all the time because they're travelling with the army and they're learning all sorts at the cutting edge of whatever their army's doing. So it can be dizzying. I mean, sometimes you end up with about 10 pages, because I try and record everything, as in have files, text files, so I can refer back to everything we've discussed. Otherwise, they'll be saying, hang on, that's not what you ruled. Why has that changed? But it can be, there can be 10 pages of 10-point text just as a discussion with some players. I mean, every player is different. Some are happy with a very general order and then they let their army commanders get on with it. And some lean towards almost micromanaging, you know, which is tempting to do when you're physically with the army or with one of your banners. So it's a mass of communications going back and forth between me and, well, there's always been between 6 and 8 players. And then, of course, when there's a battle, we have to arrange a game. And that's where one of the big delays that comes in. This is one of the reasons it's been 13 years. Trying to, with real-world obligations, real lives, trying to get 2 guys from a different part of the country, sometimes 3, sometimes 4, to all be available to play a game on the same day. That can take months sometimes to arrange. So that's one of the things that slows the game down. But to be honest, I then use that time to paint more figures and to write more illustrated stories, connecting it all up and such. So I feel like I'm active in the campaign all the time, but the players can feel, I mean, some of them have been inactive for nearly 2 years just because it's taken 2 years for 3 seasons to go by and they've not done much beyond recovering during that time.
How long is a season?
It's not measured in real world. In a real world sense, it's basically 4 turns. And a season, I think, in the game is about 3 months. But the turns, I just assume there are several weeks. That's all quite hazy. I don't think you need to be that detailed on things like that, especially in a kind of medieval, Renaissance fantasy world.
Can you explain what you mean by turns then, at the risk of asking a stupid question?
Well, yeah, in the original Mighty Empire game, every season had 4 turns. So in every turn, you can move a certain number of hexes, if you see what I mean. So, and if a battle takes place, that tends to consume that turn. It's unlikely you'll move to another hex and fight another battle in the same turn. Of course, with a games master, if that's the orders, if it's some sort of lightning progression, then maybe that would be incorporated and such. But yeah, I mean, the players give me their orders at the start of a season, and those orders are meant to apply for the whole 4 turns of that season. But of course, if they're with an army, during each turn, they're getting information from me, and they're changing their orders anyway because they're actually actively campaigning with the army. They're being fighting front generals. So, yeah.
You've touched on the interaction so far with the players. Like, how, I mean, you've said that, you know, you could be in the pub with one guy, whereas you're getting emails from somebody else. Like, is there a limit or a system for them interacting with you and giving orders and stuff like that? How does it all kind of work?
Not really. I mean, like I said, some will give me a few sentences for their orders, and some will engage in a vast discussion. But at the end of the day, I try and get the orders onto, for all the players, 6 to 8 players, onto one sheet of A4 by using shorthand and all sorts. But I'll cut it down to the basics. I'll send them my version of the finalised orders, because if we've talked for days over orders and possibilities, I want them to see this is what I'm going to act on. And they usually okay it and say, yeah, that's pretty much where I am. That's it. So I just like the idea of being able to refer to one page for the orders for that season. It's complicated enough with the players changing the orders if they're actively marching around and such. Sorry.
I was just going to say, where are you documenting all this? Like, is there a brain like that you're putting all this into, like software or whatever?
Not really, no. I've never really got into spreadsheets and all that kind of thing. Although one of my players uses spreadsheets for his army list, and I get so confused, even just trying to print it out and find the information, looking at this strange collection of boxes, most of which seem to be blank, and I'm like, where the heck's the army? You know, I can't find the army. So, it's done the old-fashioned way. I have a pencil record of everything that I've GM'd, all the map moves, all the times I've had to make dice rolls, and this, that, and the other. I've also got the email record, which is the communications record, which I then collate into a word process file and have in chronological order. Then, bizarrely, I riffle shuffle the two together so that the pencil notes that connect to these particular word processed communications, they are all next to each other physically. And I end up with this big pile of papers for every season where it's half printed, half pencil notes, but all in chronological order, turn by turn by turn. So six players for one turn, then six players for the next turn, then six players for the next turn. And it means that I can find stuff later on because, like I said, it's part of being an effective games master. The players want me to be fair, to be consistent. So I need that record. You never know what tiny detail's going to become crucial later on, and if you don't record it, then you've got to rule again on it and such. So yeah,
it made me think before we were chatting about there's this thing I've heard of in improv called yes and. You know, when people are doing improv performances, and the rule of thumb seems to be like you're never allowed to just say no, or you know, if somebody comes up with something, no matter how outlandish, you've got to kind of run with it. And I'm curious as to how much you relate to that as a GM. And I'm not necessarily saying you just let players do what they want, but if they want to try and push a story in a certain direction, presumably they'll have the opportunity to at least try to pull it off. Does that kind of resonate at all?
That last thing you said is the important bit. I don't say you can do whatever you want. I say you can try whatever you want to try. You can give whatever orders you want. All my job as the games master is, well, there's the first job, it's the advisors. And whenever I give advice, they tend to get three. They'll get the guy who really likes the idea and is singing its praises. They'll have a guy who's kind of neutral and saying, well, we'll need to do this, that, and the other as well. And the guy who's really against it. And I don't weight them. I just wait for the player to decide which one they're going to do. But as games master, I then basically cost it and come up with rules for it. For example, the Porta Majoran player, Damien, he wanted a colossus, a bit like the Colossus of Rhodes. This huge mechanical, magico-mechanical giant, which was going to guard his city. And he said can we use the stats from, I think it's called a Hero Titan in the Tomb King's army list. So I said, right, well, we're lifting it from another book, from a different army list. So I don't know if I increase the cost by two or one and a half. But anyway, I said, I'm going to increase the cost. So he had to pay more supply points because every supply point is meant to buy you 2,000 points worth of troops or casualty recoveries. But that cost him more. And then on top of that, I said, you're going to have to assign a wizard, at least level 3, who's the one who's brought this thing to life and is needed to keep it going and to control it and such. So all of that was done. He paid the extra points. He had to pay points to get this wizard, the wizard Hakim, to look after it. And then about two seasons later, even though this was meant to be this thing that was going to defend his city, standing there, scanning the seas and scanning the land, he said, I want to take it on campaign with me. So I said, right then, there's going to be an extra supply point cost for your army, not just the subsistence, but all the horses and wagons, the ridiculous number of oxen and wagons and such you need to haul these huge wagons that are carrying this thing. But also, it'll slow you down massively. And it did. He was going about a half to two-thirds as fast as a regular army would. So even slower than an army hauling cannons. Now, that had consequences because he got to the end. He went north to fight the vampires, did really well, burnt Miragliano, cleansed it. On his way back, he refused to leave the Colossus, even though the Sartosan pirates had already started raiding his realm. If he'd not had the Colossus or abandoned that Colossus, he would have got there before they raised the last one or two settlements. But no, he wouldn't do it. Admittedly, it was a calculator gamble. He wanted the Colossus, and he knew as long as he got back before his capital city fell and he'd got some outlying supply settlements that he could use and he'd taken loot on his... He'd got it all balanced, but... Yeah, so it's not a matter of ever saying no. It's you'll get one advisor saying no. Oh, that's a terrible idea. but the GM's just got to come up with points, costs and such. Like with Guidobaldo Gondi. This is the guy who lives on the other side of the village. I meet him in the pub. My God, he's not a wargamer. The guy moved in next door. In fact, a guy moved in next door to me who, the day he moved in, I turned to Ruth and I said, this is me in my 30s, I said, wouldn't it be strange if this new neighbour was a Warhammer fantasy player? And it turned out he was. So, yeah, strange. So I then started gaming with him and his friends, who are now in the campaign, although he's moved away years ago. But his friends are still in the campaign. And then the guy from Two Doors Down became interested. We ended up with this weird moment where on this strip of five terrace cottages, three blokes and their wives, or ladies, were all involved in the campaign. Helen next door was a barbarian queen, and there was a princess who was the sister of her. And so the girls weren't, I call them girls, that's terrible, the women, weren't playing the games, but they were giving me the orders, they were getting reports. I used to sit in the kitchen and give them the reports that their advisors were giving them. But this guy, who was never into war games, he's the one that comes up. This is why Guidobaldo Gondi has become one of the most interesting characters in the campaign. He comes up with such Machiavellian things that I would, even if I was playing the part of advisors, I just wouldn't think of these things. The trickery that's gone on, the lies and obfuscation that's gone on constantly through him. I mean, sometimes it works and sometimes it fails. And I can't even go into the details because it's kind of all part of an ongoing story. And I'm not even sure with some of the tricks he's played whether there's anyone in the world of Tylea who can actually tell you the truth and is certain of the truth themselves. But yeah, you don't say no to him. You just say, well, that's great. Let's see how that plays out, see if that's even possible. Very cruel sort of personality, though, his player character, because he loses people all the time to these crazy schemes, but he doesn't care. They just fall by the wayside. At one point, he was challenged by, the tyrant prince. Was he called Prince Garenzo of Trantio? So he sent his son up the ladder because he had his son there as a hero character. And his son died in the challenge. But he just turned to me and said, remember when we were coming up with the background for my character? I said, yeah. And he said, I had two sons. I went, yes. He said, well, there you go. I've still got an heir. And Lord Silvano became the heir. But he had actually said that. And that would have been a little pencil note from earlier in the campaign for me to check and go, oh, yes, he did. He said he'd got two sons and the younger one's still alive. So yeah, don't say no. Just see how the story pans out.
Yeah, it sounds like lots of fantastic sort of stories, and you know, there's a whole game taking place off the table.
Yeah.
Are you able to give us examples of when the situations arrived that you've got to get one of these battles on the go, and you know, at maybe a scenario that you had to play out because of something that happened off table?
Yeah, there's so many of those in the campaign, which I sometimes worry with the videos that people will think, what is going on here? This is not like a tabletop game. Why is one army vastly outnumbered by another? Why has one army got all these strange elements? Like, for example, in the Battle for Urbino, which I think is one of the early 50s videos, 51 or 52 or 53, I can't remember, the maestro, Angelo De Leoni, had made a steam tank, and it was a Tylean version of the steam tank. It was wooden. I'd modelled this thing. I'd used an Airfix model of Trevithick's 1812 steam locomotive to create a self-propelled warp lightning cannon. So when I made the steam tank, I used little bits of plastic and stuff, because I collect all sorts of junk that I might then turn into a scratch-built model. But I basically recreated a smaller version that kind of looked like the same sort of thing. I then buried this inside this wooden shell and mounted a Hellblaster volley gun on the top and various swivel guns. I had crew and such inside. It was utterly pointless because once I put the wood around it, you could hardly see what was inside it, but I knew all the engine pieces were in there. Anyway, that was good. He went to attack one town. It could have been Viadazza, and it had nothing to do because it was an assault. So all it could do was trundle around outside the walls. Well, then later on, he was trying to attack the motored town, Walden motored town of Urbino. Well, of course, this thing wasn't going to be much use with that. But sitting in the pub with the guy, we decide, no, hang on, I've just lied. because I've got the wrong guy there. No, it was an NPC. I think Angelo Deloney. I thought I must have brainstormed some ideas that Angelo Deloney. Yeah, I'm getting muddled up. It's the Riemanns. So I brainstorm. What I do as a games master, I don't just come up with an idea. I write several ideas down and roll a dice. So I'll have come up with, I don't know, a petard or some kind of mobile platform that will get them up on the walls or some kind of battering ram. I've rolled and it came up with mobile platform and I thought, right, well, he's got the mobile element right now, the steam engine. So we decided he'd strip off the upper platform with the swivel guns and the Hellblaster volley gun and build this huge kind of perpendicular, kind of diagonal ramp. And it would just ride up to the walls with this ramp sticking out so that it would extend over the moat, touch the top of the walls, and the soldiers were meant to run up this ramp. But at that point, the vampire player said, I'm not waiting. I'm sallying out. I'm not sure why he did it, because you'd think he'd have more of a chance behind the walls, but he thought, no, I'm going out. So we ended up playing the battle. And this steam machine, which had never... I'd done a whole story about it parading through the streets and the crowds going wild at this amazing device that was going to win them the wars. It had failed in its first battle because it had nothing to do. And in its second battle, where it ended up being destroyed, it didn't even have any armament. It had a part-completed ramp on the back of it. So all it could do was trundle towards the enemy in hoping to crush them somehow. But it got caught up in a load of ethereal units and basically just was caught in it. It couldn't hurt them. They couldn't hurt it. Meanwhile, the army was destroyed and that was the end of the steam engine. So, yeah, you're constantly coming up with rules. Later on, we had another guy, Captain Guccio, who'd he had to create a petard pushed up to the walls, and he had to create these things to bridge a moat, which were like wheeled platforms with a huge wooden platform kind of stuck on the front of them, and ropes, and then these rocks, I used pebbles, to counterweight it. And the idea was you would trundle these up to the moat, and then you would drop these platforms over the moat to create these little bridges, and then the ladder-armed troops would rush over. So constantly coming up with things like the player for Porta Maggiore was attacking a really swollen moat. This is one of the recent videos. I think it's about 122 or something. The assault on Meregliano. There'd been a moat, but because the undead had the city for several seasons, in fact, several years, none of the dredging and all the stuff they'd done for the upkeep of the moat had been done. And because it was right next to the swamps, I forget what they're called, the blighted marshes, we said that the moat had swollen. So he had to create rafts to paddle across the river. But because the undead had been there for ages, I thought, right, there's got to be some consequences of the undead. So I had rules for marsh zombies that could appear. They never did because we didn't roll the right number, but I painted these zombies. Luckily, I got them into a prequel story, so at least I got some use out of them in a story, even though they were never in the battle. We had these huge rotting leviathans that had woken for underneath the marsh, these prehistoric undead creatures that rose up to the top. They never appeared either because his magic was thwarted when he was trying to conjure them and such. But there were so many rules for that. He had a battering ram on rafts. He had huge rafts with siege towers on them. We thought it was going to be a crazy game with marsh zombies attacking from the rear and leviathans coming up. I mean, it was crazy enough, but none of those elements that I'd modelled and made all these rules for, very few of them actually happened on there. Oh, no, a leviathan. No, the leviathans didn't turn up. There were some ethereal creatures that went over the moat and upturned one of the rafts with the dwarves on it, yes. I'm thinking that was a leviathan, but no, it wasn't. It was some Age of Sigmar figures I'd converted into some version of whites or something. They were difficult to convert from round, textured, stylized bases onto square bases. That was a challenge. But at least they got used in the game, unlike the regiment of 30 swamp zombies that never featured on the tabletop because of my elaborate rules for how you could call on them.
Yeah. There's a really great sort of zoom in, zoom out thing going on with your whole project, with your whole campaign, because you zoom right out to the level of a country, don't you? But if you go into, in your videos, there's just conversations between two peasants or whatever. So yeah. You've got a really good. Do you find that quite natural, that ability to see it from afar and get really into you know, kind day-to-day of lives of people?
It's, my hand is forced. I can't write what the players are thinking and planning, the player characters are thinking and planning. I can do a conversation involving them by getting the player involved, in which case they tell me their response to various... there's a lot of communication involved there. It's constantly back and forth as I say, well, this guy says this next, what do you reply? So I can put them in a story like that. But most of the time, and my hand is forced, I do the stories from non-player characters' perspectives. And according to who the characters are, where they are, what they've heard, what's going on around them, what weird diplomacy and Machiavellian tricks are going on, what misinformation's being spread, what religion they are, all these things come into it. But basically, you're presenting the story, but from an in-world character's perspective. So you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. They might be exactly right on some things, but very wrong on others. But it means I can put information out there without going overboard on the kind of, I don't know, God's eye view of things where you're literally just as if you're looking at the board and you can see exactly what's going on in a board game. And it just seems easier to have two or three people. I used to worry that there's too many instances where two or three Sartosans or two or three soldiers or two or three peasants are having a chat. But then I thought, no, it's just easier to do it that way. And then you've got two or three different opinions on everything. What so-and-so's heard, what in the temple, in the proclamation, from the neighbour, from a cousin in another town. And it allows me to do, I mean, originally, they weren't intended for the videos. They weren't even intended for the stories. It was my way of imparting the kind of gossip and traders' talk and merchants' talk that was coming into Realms, so that the players would have lots of information to work with. They'd have to decide how much of it's true, which they could trust. But then, of course, it's turned into the stories, and you can have a lot more fun with it. But it's still serving a very practical purpose, because without those stories, there's less information for the players to work on. I don't know if every player necessarily takes all the information on board. I'm not even sure if they all necessarily watch the videos or read the stories in great detail. But if so, that's not a problem, because it just means their player character is the kind of careless lord who doesn't really care what the gossips say and such, and sifting through all the ifs and buts and tiny details of things, and just gets on with their own scheming and plotting and plans.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. Do you ever struggle with emotional investment in the players, given that this is such a long-running project?
Well, I mean, it's 13 years since 2013. I do worry that the players might get bored or frustrated. I mean, like, we did a battle about a month ago, huge battle, and I'm still working on the report for it, because what I've found is the best way to get pictures is you take photographs during the game, but you don't want to interfere with the gameplay, getting people to take things off the table and trying to move a blue sky around in the background on a big board and all that kind of stuff. Slows the game down, frustrates everyone. So, I mean, this is the most ridiculously time-consuming way of doing it, but this is the best I've come up with so far. I take pictures as a record, and then once the players have gone home, it took me 2 weeks using the same table and all the same figures to set everything up and move by move, casualty by casualty, reenact the entire battle so I could take proper angled, focused pictures. So that took me 2 weeks just to get the 100 pictures. I didn't used to do so many pictures, but now I've got videos in mind. Because, I mean, up until halfway through the campaign, I didn't even imagine I was going to be doing the videos. But now I've got videos in mind. I like the idea of lots and lots of pictures. You know, you don't want something on the screen for a whole minute while you're talking about other things. You want something on the screen that's relevant for almost every part of the spoken words. And then, even at that stage, you've then got to write the story. You've got to arrange all those pictures in an order and come up with the report. Sometimes you're doing it from a strange angle, like the time I did a story from some boys' perspective, who'd one of them had watched the battle from a tower window on the wall and such. So, in a nutshell, it's a month later, and I haven't done any of my GM duties. I've kind of penciled the casualty recoveries and such, but I haven't passed that on to the players. And you've got to have patient players, where not only did it take us weeks and weeks to arrange the game to get everyone together at the same time, it then takes me weeks and weeks to even give them any information about the consequence of the game, the actual details and exactly where everyone is and such. And say to them, right, give me your next orders for the next turn. What are you doing now? So I do worry about boredom, but I think the players don't mind, purely because they're used to it and had 13 years experience of it, and they know the end result is the stories and the videos, which I think they're interested in, and they know other people are interested in. So I think they might feel like they're just contributing to this unfolding story that's got that's been put out to the public. But without the videos, without the stories, and without the crazy modelling projects and such, the campaign would run. This would be a 3-year campaign, not a 13 years campaign. But we have had. We've had one person leave the campaign and leave the hobby out of sheer frustration. Literally walking out on a game was the strangest thing. I fully understand his frustration. He was taking on an alliance of four armies, and it had taken the organiser of the alliance a real world year to put this together with the diplomacy and the ambassadors and this, that and the other. And each of these Tylian states didn't have a powerful army, but I'd got this pattern for what a standing army would be, the core of an army around which you were meant to recruit a bigger army should you need to defend yourself or go on an offensive war. So every army had some sort of foot troop, some sort of horse, light or heavy, some sort of artillery, an engineer to look after them, maybe a wizard. And then you'd build from that little core of, say, I don't know, 800, 900 points with the supply points that they'd got stored. So what had happened on this game is there was this battery of 6 or 7 cannons on this hill. There was like, I think it was 5 engineers up there, because 3 little realms had brought their own engineer and the main player had brought 2. And in the campaign army list, it said you could pay for an engineer. If you wanted a second one, you had to pay double the cost. So he paid double the cost. So there's 5 engineers up there. Now, can you imagine the damage done to his Terrorgeist and his Mortis engine by 7 cannons with 5 engineers re-rolling? I mean, they just destroyed them in the first turn. And he was so disgusted, thinking that somehow this was utterly unfair, that he left the campaign. And yet, I knew, well, it's kind of unfair on the day, but this player has put all that work into it. There's a reason that the multiple engineers is an accident of a doctrine I created for my little world, where each nation would make sure it had an aspect of every kind of troop in its little standing army and an engineer to look after whatever one artillery piece they had. And the player coming up with this strategy and putting the time and effort into it to make sure that he wasn't arriving with his 2,500-point army, he was arriving with a 5,000-point army, with Varezans and Pavonans and Lucinans, as well as his Porta Majorans. Can't even remember who the 5th army was. So it can be frustrating, but I think that player was used to playing one-off games with equal points of armies. And even though he'd been in the campaign for quite some time, this was just such a shock to him, almost as if everyone was ganging up on him, which of course they were doing. I mean, I put him in the far north because I thought, hang on, he's a natural, as a vampire, he's everyone's enemy. Even the Machiavellian types in the south are going to be threatened by a vampire and want to deal with him. So I'd put him in the north and I'd given him slightly larger starting forces and such. So I tried to balance it that way, which is, I mean, you might say that's the referee sort of, too much referee influence and stuff. But I thought, well, the story, the world wouldn't exist if he was in the middle of everyone, because he would have never been allowed to grow. He must be on a corner somewhere. He must be out on the periphery where people can't get to him. Otherwise, he would have never got to the point where this vampire was commanding armies. So It made sense story-wise as well. But yeah, that's the only bad feeling I think we've had in the campaign, and I feel guilty about it to this day. And yet at the same time, I kind of think, well, until it happened, we had no idea he'd see it that way.
Yeah, just an unfortunate mismatch of expectations, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact you've been going so long and that's been the only incident must be a good thing. Are there any other potential pitfalls to be aware of for going super narrative? You know, for anyone listening that's thinking about doing some, not necessarily the same, but some sort of narrative campaign, anything else that they should maybe watch out for?
Well, you can't underestimate the lack of balance in the tabletop games that are caused by strategic decisions, diplomacy, trickery plots, just the decision to separate your realm's army into two separate banners because you're worried about the north and you're worried about the south. And then the enemy comes just from one direction, suddenly outnumbers you twice, 2-1. These kind of things. The trick is for the players to understand that the game is, I think you kind of referred to it earlier on, it's as much about the strategy, the diplomacy, and that board game map level play as it is the tabletop play. That imbalance, I think, is the thing that strikes people. I think it makes for marvellous stories and campaign reports. Like the time the Pavonan player had raised he'd captured the city of Trantio, and then when he realised Razgar Boldigut's double army of ogres was coming towards him, he raised his own city. He decided, well, I'm not having them raise this newly captured city and take the loot for themselves. I'm raising my own newly... So he raised the city and then took the populace, a lot of them, this great mob of labourers and servants and such, workers, and tried to make it to another city that he'd recently captured, Astiano. So we did a scenario, because the ogres had a better movement rate and such, and I thought, they're going to catch them. We did a scenario where we had the walls of the city, we had his standing force and a few extra regiments he put in there in the city. We had the refugees kind of at one corner of the table at the other side and the ogres at one corner of the table on the other side. So that there was this race. There was the baggage worth so many supply points, the big mob of peasants worth so many points and such. And... it was completely unbalanced. There was no way the Pavonans were going to win. They weren't going to defeat the ogres. But could they get some of the supply points they'd raised, some of the people, some of the forces they were bringing from Trantio into the city walls? And of course, it led for an amazing story, or it created an amazing story, because at one point he made the decision. He thought, right, that's it. If I keep the gates open any longer, I risk them bursting in. And then it becomes an assault of this city. You know, and I think he was hoping reinforcements would get there and he could perhaps, with enough troops, make a stand there. So he shut the gates. And he shut the gates on the women and children of these poor peasants outside. He'd got some baggage in, he'd got his volley gun in, and he shut the gates. So you get a lot of unbalanced combat, so tabletop games, but they can be unbalanced in a scenario, says. I'm a games master. I'm very rarely a player. But I keep thinking I would enjoy just as much, if not more so, being the small army on a field and seeing if I can achieve an objective before I die gloriously. Mm. To me, that's as much fun. The narrative side of it is what it's about. You know, I don't watch football and sport and such with leagues and semi-finals. And, you know, it's the story. But not all players like that. They don't like the imbalance that comes about. That's the major pitfall, I think.
Yeah, it's all about victory conditions, isn't it? Like a victory objective for you as 200 men holding out against, you know, 100,000, the victory objective is going to be different, isn't it? It's just going to be, you know, how many of these guys could we take with us before we die? It's pure storytelling, isn't it? I mean, as much as you're a games master, you're a storyteller at the essence of it all, aren't you?
And because you put, or because I put all the effort into the story, because I have this vast record of notes and every little decision, you know, where even the NPCs and such. I mean, if a player sends an army out under another commander, one of their own servants, that becomes an NPC force. They've got their orders, But at the end of the day, if a new situation arises that the player hadn't predicted in the orders, then the player's not there. The player can't do anything because the player is the player character, that one individual person somewhere in the campaign world. So even the player's forces can end up with me thinking, right, I'll come up with three things, a cautious idea, a middling idea, and a bold idea, and I'll roll between them. But what I tend to do then is I record what the result is, and I remember that that particular NPC was bold. So I will then subsequently, if they're in a similar situation, I will weight the options towards bold ideas, so that there's far more likely that it's far more likely that he'll do the bolder thing. The scenarios for the tabletop games always arise from those stories, from either an NPC's decisions or the player's orders coming to fruition, or certain orders meeting a certain event, a certain circumstance. I never really think, right, how can I make this game interesting? Because I'm happy with a game just being two armies meet on the field. That happens. Recently, it's been happening quite a lot. But what you tend to find is half the time the armies meet and you think, oh, bugger, I'm going to have to include this situation, and of course they've got that with them, so I'm going to incorporate that into it. So the scenarios just seem to arise from the story, from the player's orders, from the NPC's decisions, from the particular strange thing, you know, the fact that a Colossus has been involved in the army, or an engineer's come up with strange petards and moat bridges. All of these things drive the scenarios, rather than me thinking, oh, I need to come up with something, some kind of victory conditions and such, you know. And we've got the rules for victory. I mean, for example, if you win a game, you get half the casualties on the field back and everyone who ran off the table. If it's a draw, you get a third of the casualties on the field back. If it's a loss, you can run away with whoever left your table edge, but you lose everything else. You know, there's rules for parleys. There's rules for casualty recovery for heroes, whether they're captured, whether they're wounded, whether they escape. All this kind of stuff is there. These mechanics are all there. So even a straightforward tabletop battle with no particular scenario rules still has a bunch of paperwork and calculations to be done at the end of it to work out what's happened as a consequence. I think sometimes people who watch the videos might think, hang on, they took a lot of casualties that battle. How come the army still seems substantial? But if your 40 regiment lost 20 men but regained 10 because they won the battle, you've now got a 30 regiment. It's still substantial. The trick is to keep winning and keep so that any casualties you get, you get more and more of them back.
A massive thanks to Padre for taking the time to chat, and I will, of course, stick a link to the Talia's Troubles YouTube channel in the show notes. A final call too for returned hobbyists to take my midlife hobby renaissance survey. You'll find the link in the show notes too, or at bedroombattlefields.com/survey. I massively appreciate your time if you're able to fill that out. Alright, that is it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks once again for listening, and we'll chat again on the next one.